I will now pass it over to Jennifer Hanna, who will open today's call.
Thank you, Megan, and good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for joining us today. I am Jennifer Hanna, the Deputy Director for ASPR's National Healthcare Preparedness Program, or NHPP branch. Before I hand it over to our first speaker, I would like to provide a brief overview of what we will cover today. Next slide. First, I will provide a few ASPR Healthcare Readiness Programs updates. Next, Shane Brandman and Dr. John Hick will provide an update and demo of the new DASH tool. Afterwards, Captain Dwayne Wagner will lead this month's regional panel. Finally, we will leave some time at the end for questions from the audience. I'd like to begin today's webinar with a couple of administrative updates. As you all know, the Cooperative Agreement Accountability and Management Platform, or CAMP, is open to recipients and subrecipients for end-of-year data collection. The data collection period began on July 6th and will run through Friday, September 9, 2022. Next, I would like to take a moment and highlight two recently published stories from the field. Stories from the field provide the opportunity to highlight the hard work and accomplishments of our recipients and our subrecipients. We have recently published two new stories from the field highlighting efforts in Illinois and Kentucky. Both stories provide an example of the diversity of support that ASPR funding offers recipients and subrecipients as they bolster emergency preparedness and response. To read these stories and others, head to the Stories from the Field page on aspr.hhs.gov. For your reference, a member of our team will share the Stories from the Field page link in the chat momentarily. I will now pass it over to Shane Brandman to present on the ASPR Tracy DASH tool. Shane?
And if everyone will give us a moment here, I believe Shane had to leave and re-enter the call for her audio. So just give us one moment.
Good afternoon, everyone. Can you hear me now?
Yes, we can.
Okay. Again, thanks for this opportunity. And we're delighted to be able to provide you an update on the Disaster Available Supplies in Hospitals, or DASH tool. And thank you to many of you on the line today who have already reviewed and provided comments on the drafts of this tool. We've received feedback from almost 100 subject matter experts, which has allowed us to make many improvements as we've refined the DASH tool over the last year. This project originated as a specific request from an ASPR Tracy user and followed numerous similar technical assistance requests in recent years. While many resources are available related to planning and training for various scenarios, a gap existed in helping ASPR Tracy users determine how many supplies their hospitals need for the initial response to a disaster. To address this gap, DASH focused on supplies in four complementary domains: pharmaceuticals, personal protective equipment, burn, and trauma. Next slide. ASPR Tracy has been working with Healthcare Ready, HIDA, the Region 7 Disaster Health Response Ecosystem, and many other SMEs on the DASH tool since 2021. Our process for each of the four modules has been to look at the threat, identify and review relevant state plans and recommendations, review specialty society recommendations for supply stocking, and examine historical incidents for supplies and quantity used. Based on those environmental scans, we developed initial framework to discuss with select SMEs before seeking broader SME input. This process allowed us to develop a tool intended to help hospitals understand what supplies they need to have on hand for the 90% of incidents that they may occur in their area. We look forward to hearing from you and your members on how DASH is used. And as we roll out the final modules, actually next Monday afternoon, we'll be formally launching all four DASH modules, and we'll be sending out a Tracy Express devoted explicitly to the DASH tool. We really want you to join our webinar that's devoted to this subject at 11:30 Eastern Standard Time on August 15th, as we officially continue to launch the tool. And again, share that link with others that you think might benefit from this. It's now my distinct pleasure and honor to turn over to senior editor, Dr. John Hick, who gave countless hours of his time to be able to develop this tool in conjunction with Jennifer Naracco from the Asper Tracy team and our HIDA counterparts. They worked long weekends to be able to provide this to you. So John, thank you as always for your dedication, and over to you, sir.
Thanks so much, Shane. So I'm just gonna try to do a live demo here and let me know if this is not working, but you can ignore all the birthday ideas at the top of the screen for my daughter. But this is, as you can see, dashtool.org. And so this is live right now. Now, this is your landing page right here. And so what you'll see as you scroll down is you have the hospital pharmacy module, the personal protective equipment module, the burn supply module, and trauma supply module. Each of these is complementary. And so you really can't prepare for trauma without having adequate pharmaceuticals in place. Under the burn supply module, there's a number of supplies that might be required for surgical interventions or airway interventions during burn care that are listed in the trauma supply module. So we intend these to be complementary modules. And in order to avoid duplication, you know, we have parsed out supplies in the different modules depending on, you know, where they seem to most fit. So I'll just do a demo of a couple of quick things here. So for the hospital pharmacy module, we'll go in. And so the first thing you'll see is just some background information on what this is designed to do. And again, as Shane mentioned, this is designed to help a community identify based on its hospital characteristics, you know, what resources they ought to have on the shelf to meet the needs of 90% of the events. So we have some instructions, and that's basically about how to complete the forms and, you know, how to download your information and make sure that you save it. Also the methodology, which is really, really important to read through, because the methodology really tells you about the assumptions and limitations that we're operating under, you know, as we complete each of the modules. It may also help you to prompt to think about, you know, issues with your supply chain or discussion issues with your coalition about, you know, how many supplies should be thinking about having available within our region, within our state, you know, based on what your particular regional characteristics are. So the instructions and methodology are extremely important. I know everyone says that, whether it's a lawnmower or, you know, a dehumidifier you're opening, but you really do need to read the instructions and the methods here in order to get the most out of the tool. So what we'll do first is to put our hospital characteristics in. So we're going to choose our trauma level, and this is basically your American College of Surgeons or ATS trauma level. We'll choose our emergency department beds, and I'm just going to put 30 in, which is somewhat over average. No burn beds at our inpatient location. We don't transfer trauma patients to a higher level of care. That's particularly appropriate for small community hospitals and critical access hospitals. Is this hospital the only hospital in the area, or is it at disproportionate risk of taking a major share of burn or trauma patients? And if the answer to that is yes, and I'll choose yes here, and you can see how that changes our requirements on the right side, we're going to increase your requirements there by 50%. Also, if there's a natural disaster, you know, you could anticipate a hurricane, a flood event, or something else isolating the hospital for days or longer, you will see also that that is going to essentially double your requirements, so that from a pharmaceutical standpoint, instead of predicting needs for the first 48 hours of care, now we're looking at 96 hours of care. You will notice that when we double the time here under natural disasters, it does wind up doubling the number of patients. Again, that's explained in the methods. There's not much we can do about that. But essentially what we're asking for there is just a prolonged time frame. So you can see now in the different categories of pharmaceuticals and IV fluids that you would normally stock at your pharmacy, what our goals are. But you don't have to pay too much attention to that. So let's just We'll go into one category here. So let's just choose antibiotics, because there are some pediatric specific examples here. And pediatrics is integrated into these modules. So when there are appropriate liquid formulations of antibiotics or the appropriate sized endotracheal tubes or things like that, that's accounted for pediatrics and for a percent of pediatric population, you know, that we would anticipate being affected. And otherwise, if we have enough morphine or if we have enough, analgesic or sedation for an adult, and we would normally use that for a pediatric patient, then we'll still have more than enough. So let's just go to oral antibiotics here. And here, based on your input, is your target. You'll notice there's a hover there that gives you more information. You'll also see how these different formulations, whether it's a suspension of amoxicillin or a tablet of doxycycline, how that applies to your total needs. And that's based on dosing. So how many times a day do you need it? How many tablets? You know, what total dose? So let's just say that we have a lot of Keflex tablets around. So we have 1,000 tablets of Keflex. And now you can see that we're already in the green. We've already exceeded our total goal for narrow spectrum oral antibiotics. And so we can, you know, return to the index at any point here, choose a different category, for instance, of intravenous fluids, and work through that. Whenever we're done putting information into the tool, we can download those as PDFs. We can save a link to come back and continue to work on the data that we have entered. It is not possible to download the data in an Excel spreadsheet. That's one of the limitations of the Tableau environment. But we think nonetheless that you will find the modules very helpful. I just want to take a quick look at the burn supply module here. I'll leave you to explore the personal protective equipment module and the trauma supply module on your own. The PPE module, great thanks to University of Nebraska, our NETEC partners, and others that assisted with that. That looks at preparations for patients with special respiratory precautions, patients with viral hemorrhagic fever, and then predictive tools for pandemic PPE consumption based on different assumptions about mask or respirator reuse. Also, many thanks to the American College of Surgeons personnel and the American Burn Association members that provided valuable input into burn supply and trauma supply, and a number of hospital and other pharmacists that provided input into the hospital pharmacy calculator. So the burn supply module, we'll just again go through here. There's the instructions and the methodology. Again, it's very important to put your trauma level in, because that will help drive your requirements. We're going to choose a trauma level 3, which would be a community, you know, hospital of reasonable size that offers some surgical resources. And in this case, when we put in 30 emergency department beds, it is going to increase the numbers of burn patients that we would be anticipating receiving, just because emergency departments that are in excess of certain numbers of beds are actually providing a range of emergency services that equates with a capacity that is larger than the 5 burn victims that are predicted for a small community hospital to be prepared for. If you provide inpatient burn care, obviously your requirements will change. And if you are a primary receiving center for burn patients in your area, also, that will change. Same thing with the question, as we saw in pharmacy, about natural disasters, isolating the facility. So at level 3 and with 30 emergency department beds, we're preparing to receive 15 burn inpatients and 45 burn outpatients from a mass burn event. If we were to change this number to 15, you will see that adjusts down to a lower level of preparedness for 5 burn inpatients and 20 burn outpatients. So the burn module really concentrates on topicals, and there are a number of topicals that may be used for burn treatment, including primarily bacitracin, maffinide acetate, and silver sulfadiazine. Because these can be very complementary and are used in different circumstances, we'd like you to have some of each of those around. And you'll see that reflected in the bar here with some goals in each of these. And then with the remainder, with the orange bar, 40%, it's dealer's choice. You can choose what other products you would prefer to stock based on your local preferences. So let's say that you, in preparing for 5 burn patients, have two of the 1 pound tubs of mafenide, you have two of sulfur solvadiazine, and then two of bacitracin. You have now met your topical treatment needs for those burn patients, and you can move on now to the next page and figure out what sort of dressings you're going to use. And you have multiple choices here, again, depending on your preferences. If you happen to have silver impregnated products, that's fantastic. That is the standard. And yet we know most community hospitals won't be stocking those. So you have many options here from burn dressing gauze to Adaptic to other forms. Again, once completed, this will give you an inventory that allows you to see, you know, whether or not you would have adequate dressings for a 40% burn in an average size adult patient for the number of burn patients that you're community hospital, your trauma center, your burn center would be anticipating receiving. And if you decide to change your assumptions, you can see these numbers change and you can adjust accordingly. And you may decide that you want to have more supplies on hand than what the tool predicts. So we hope this tool will provide a really good way for hospitals to look at what they have available, what they want to have available, and work with their supply chain and their local coalitions, as well as their states on, you know, what is reasonable to, you know, have on hand, and using that then as a springboard to what does it make sense to have in a regional cache? How do we access burn dressings under the SNS, for example, that might be needed in a much larger event? How quickly can those come and where do they get delivered? So we think this tool will help a lot to set some baseline assumptions for what hospitals may have on hand. Again, this tool is strictly voluntary, but we think it is a great driver for discussion amongst the different disciplines within the hospital, as well as supply chain and with healthcare coalitions. So with that, I'm going to stop screen sharing here. And I think we have a few minutes for Shane and I to take any questions that you might have. Look forward to the webinar coming up in August. And thank you, Jennifer and Megan, for your time on the agenda today. I'll assume that you'll have more questions as you start to use the tool, and you're always welcome to contact us at Ask Asper Tracy. That information is always available on the dashtool.org website. I do see one question in the chat here. So for a COVID surge, and this is a great question, whether we have a module for medical needs. So from a critical care standpoint, that is something that we have looked at. We did not have, this was done on a very tight deadline, was initially done to look at PPE, but we wanted to expand that to look at more all hazards. You'll find a lot of the items that you would need for a COVID surge, especially from an airway management standpoint, in the trauma calculator, and you'll be able to use that to kind of look at the number of patients and those with critical illness that would also need the same supplies like Foley catheters, NG tubes, endotracheal tubes reflected there that would be needed for general critical care. So there is significant overlap there with your medical needs. Same thing with your pharmaceuticals, all of the sedatives, many of the antibiotics and other things that you might need, you know, to manage a larger medical event are in there. Because a bioterrorism event does not fit in with any kind of standard community mass casualty planning, and we don't really have any benchmarks for determining a reasonable threshold, and that is, you know, what the SNS is designed for specifically, we did not develop specific recommendations around a bioterrorism event. That's something that certainly we could, you know, develop some models for in the future, potentially based on a scalable assumption about hundreds or thousands of victims and how they might be affected and what level of hospitalization they might require. But unfortunately, that is a little bit of shooting in the dark because we don't have a lot of good models to base that on. But great question. Thank you.
And this is Shane from Asper Tracy. So again, we're going to be rolling this out on Monday afternoon formally. You'll get an express and you can go to the site now, but we'll formally introduce it Monday afternoon. I strongly encourage each of you to sign up for that webinar. So John will walk you through some additional specifics about all four modules, and we'll have guests from Healthcare Ready, HIDA, and Nebraska Medicine on as well. And we'll keep these out there for about 6 months and keep getting feedback on how to continue to improve and build upon these modules. They're really very good, but they're not perfect. And we know that going into this, but take a good look at them, scrub it for us, and then get back to us in the next 6 months, and we'll see where we're at and what additional improvements could be made upon the DASH modules. Thank you very much for the time.
And I just want to address Deanna's question. So pediatrics are not broken out by age group, but what we do is we estimate a percentage of potential victims we might expect for each category of equipment. And so, for example, for neonates, it would be quite unusual to have a significant percentage of neonates involved in a disaster for, say, trauma. On the other hand, you know, as we've seen too often with school and other settings, young children may be affected. And so, you know, we've tried to include a reasonable percentage of endotracheal tubes and things like that across the, you know, pediatric size range that might be required. So again, always open to continued feedback on this. The good news with pharmaceuticals and burn dressings and a lot of the trauma materials is that if we're, you know, managing a 70 kilogram person, we can then manage a 7 kilogram person, you know, very effectively as well. But we want to make sure, and I think we've included, you know, the appropriate size, you know, feeding tubes, catheters, endotracheal tubes at a reasonable percentage for, you know, the casualties that we might expect from a community event, including one that might occur in a school environment. So hopefully that's helpful.
Thanks, John. And now, Megan, back to you. I think we've taken our time here with Tracy. We don't want to crowd out. We know we've got a great presentation coming up. So thank you very much.
No worries at all. Actually, we have one more question, if you all don't mind, that came in through the chat. It's asking, does ASPR plan to develop this for radiation, chemical, et cetera, to match the HCC surge annexes being developed? Could you all answer that one?
Yeah, that's a great question. So again, while we have, you know, some pretty good, we've got some pretty good historical events for burn and for, you know, mass trauma that we can draw on to, you know, recommend on-shelf materials. There is very little to guide us from a, you know, chemical and radiation standpoint. Also, there are actually very, very few specific, you know, radio pharmaceuticals that we would expect a hospital to have on hand. That really does come down to specialty stocking at the state and federal level. But SSKI is included as a possible recommendation on the pharmaceuticals, as are some discussion around atropine and pralidoxime, and how a hospital might consider stocking those and then work in concert with ChemPAC and other resources within the community. So in general, for, you know, on-shelf supplies, unless you're talking about chemical PPE, and we do not have really good modeling for, you know, because this is a voluntary tool, you know, recommendations for how many sets of chemical PPE you might need are going to be very dependent on your local hazard analysis and not on us telling you that you should have, you know, 5 sets, for example. So we have looked at chemical, we've looked at radiation. At least at this point, our determination is that we don't have very good bases for recommendations for hospitals to have specific supplies in those domains on hand for direct patient care. But, you know, if we have further information or if there's other things that can be done, again, some modeling and some potential, you know, recommendations could be possible. But as far as like on-shelf recommendations based on historical events at a 90% threshold, that gets a little bit more difficult. Thank you.
Wonderful. Well, thank you both so much for taking the time to present to us today. We would very much appreciate it. I will now pass it over to Captain Dwayne Wagner, who is the Field Project Officer for Region 5. Captain Wagner will introduce and moderate today's Hospital Association Regional Panel on Pediatric Surge during COVID-19.
Thank you, Megan, and good afternoon, everyone. Is my audio okay?
Yep, it's working great.
Thank you. I'm really excited to be here today for the second of our monthly regional panels. During each of the monthly webinars, healthcare representatives from one of the HHS regions participate in a panel highlighting hot topics and lessons learned from COVID-19. This month, healthcare representatives from Region 5 will be discussing how they manage pediatric surge throughout the COVID-19 pandemic. It's my pleasure to be joined by several healthcare representatives today. As you can see from this slide, we have a diverse group of esteemed colleagues from across Region 5. Group includes Dr. Matthew Denneberg from Michigan, Dr. Emily Chapman from Minnesota, Kathleen Shanahan from Illinois, Dr. Dina Dahlgrove and Jim Giuliano from Ohio, Dr. Roxana Lafort and Dr. Samina Brumbaugh from Indiana, and Dr. Maureen Lucci from Wisconsin. So we're excited to have each of you on the call today. Thank you all for taking time out of your busy schedule. We're looking forward to hearing about the experiences, challenges, and accomplishments each of you had. And I will start by going over logistics for today's panel. Panelists, I will read each discussion question and indicate who will start the conversation. Feel free to add to another panelist what they have said, even if you've already gone. For those in the audience, feel free to enter your questions in the chat during the panel discussion. We will address them during the Q&A portion of this call. So my first question focuses on before the pandemic. Prior to the pandemic, what were the most effective strategies used to support pediatric surge? And I'll start with Jim Giuliano, please, and Kathleen Shanahan on this one. I'm curious to hear about your perspective from an administrative level.
Well, thank you, Captain Wagner. I'll start off by just saying that this takes me back to about the fall of 2019, where in Ohio, we experienced an RSV surge of sorts. And again, you know, thinking about pre-pandemic and how we functioned, I think the two key words would be collaboration and communication. I'd probably throw triage in there as well, but the value of collaboration with between our pediatric hospitals and our community hospitals on looking at, you know, which patients could potentially be transferred to adult hospitals, which patients absolutely by criteria needed to stay at a pediatric acute care hospital was so very important. And I think that that collaboration, that communication certainly existed before the pandemic. It was heightened during the pandemic, but that was very key to our work in Ohio with many of our hospitals. So that's how I would summarize the pre-pandemic.
Hi, this is Kathy Shanahan. Can you hear me? I know you can't see me. I'm sorry. I apologize for no video. James, we had the same situation where we have what surges us at our facility, and we are a freestanding pediatric facility in Illinois, and actually in downtown Chicago, was not the COVID, but it really was more of the flu and RSV. So that's happened long before this. So we've been really prepared for it. And one of the things that we do is a daily operational safety call in the morning. So you have a sense of how things are gonna go with all the main key stakeholders. And that really helped us set the stage for how the day would go. But we have a pretty robust surge plan at our facility with additional spaces, additional staffing, how we would get them to deal with this. So it's kind of like a Tuesday to us in the winter, dealing with this kind of event that goes on all the time. And I know we're going to talk about COVID, but that didn't stress us as much as, say, the flu does or RSV does. So I hope that helps.
Yeah, thank you for that. Turning next to Dr. Dahlgrove, Dr. Lafort, and Dr. Lucci, anything to add from your clinical perspectives?
So this is Deanna. So I agree with James with regard to how Ohio hospitals work together, but I would say one of the things that we actually had going for us before the pandemic was that we actually already had a pediatric disaster coalition that was sort of in partnership with EMSC and the HBP partners in Ohio. And that really helped with the communication strategies between the hospitals, as well as some of the planning tools that we could start to think about from looking at our Ohio-based bed board for bed tracking, looking at the age of patients, things like that. So those were tools that we sort of worked on in the background that I think really helped when you have to manage such things as RSV patients other infectious things that usually happen in the pediatric community. And we had that going long before the pandemic.
Yeah, this is Roxanne Elford. So I would say, just kind of going along with what everyone else has said, that one of the big focuses pre-COVID was really on getting our non-pediatric centers very peds ready. And that was to help us in the surge events so that, you know, the main pediatric centers wouldn't be overwhelmed, but allowing some of these other non-pediatric centers to have the tools and the protocols and the education to be able to care for children appropriately and not have to transfer everything over.
Yeah, this is Maureen from Children's Wisconsin. I do think that we were looking at surge in kind of two different areas. We had surge for our traumas, our mass casualty incidents, which we practiced every once in a while, but it was not nearly the norm that I feel like we do it now. And then you had your viral surges, which we felt like there were patterns that we knew when it was going to happen. We knew when the winter volumes were going to go up. And that's where I feel like COVID switched a lot of this for us. And we had to standardize our surge practice a little bit better and have much more concrete numbers on when we needed to have an influx and then again, de-escalate things. And so it did make us look through our surge practices and change it up a little bit.
I think just to echo what Maureen was mentioning too, this is Samina Bumbra from Riley Children's, is that here at Riley, we've done for the last 20 years a respiratory viral tracking report where through the system, our BioFire assays are tracked and we can try and start to see trends before they become more apparent through the ER too. And that's really helped us predict where clinical needs are in the future.
Yeah, thank you. Dr. Chapman and Dr. Denenberg, I'm interested in your perspective as well, if you have anything to add.
Emily, I would say, you know, when you first asked the question before the others answered, you know, one of my thoughts was really, how did we handle these things? Was we handled them internally. You know, you basically were prepped to have your teams be able to staff up as needed, and particularly, you know, seasonal staffing differentiation and writing that into physician contracts to anticipate that, you know, they would have more shifts in the hospitalist realm in the winter in anticipation of that, the flexibility with your nursing staff. And I think that was one of the major shifts, was that we very much looked at it as a single siloed entity and how we managed surge. And that's what shifted with COVID.
This is Matthew Denenberg. The one thing I would add, I can't add anything to what's already been said because we were part of a lot of that in Michigan as well. But one thing I will add is right after H1N1 and before COVID, we formed a coalition or a collaboration of 11 hospitals across the state of Michigan that served most of the kids. So the three standalone children's hospitals, the four or five other children's hospitals, and then the large health systems that are in remote areas that serve the most children in those areas. And we got on a call every Monday for 15 minutes and had our version of a multi-system DCI. And mostly during RSV season, right? We all have surges during RSV season, but then that very quickly during a flood in Kalamazoo, we turned every Monday. And then during COVID, we were meeting twice a week and we turned that into a dashboard so that we kind of knew what was going across the state. And it came in handy, right? One hospital, Children's Hospital of Michigan, may have been full of ICU beds so that they could get on the phone call on Monday and we could move patients around the state, bypassing our infrastructure of our large health system. So we just sort of a grassroots group of us from the children's specific hospitals across the state just got together every Monday and had a phone call. And we've stayed in touch ever since then. We talk every Monday still, and we text each other when we need things. And so we bypass our CEOs and our presidents and the people that would stop us in a moment of need. So we're formalizing some of that with the state now. So we're making it a little bit less grassroots and a little bit more real. So.
Very good, thank you. My next question deals with the challenges each of your states or locales faced. What were some of the most difficult challenges in triage and treatment, for example, of pediatric COVID-19 cases? And also, if you could maybe elaborate on how you overcame some of those challenges. So for this one, if we could start, please, with Dr. Dahl, Dr. Lafort, and Dr. Lucci.
Well, I'll jump in. So there were a couple things that I think really came to light. So we're Region 5 for Kids, and obviously, you know, we have a lot of connections with everybody. So the thing that was really helpful for us was actually the collaboration that we had with, initially we were the Eastern Great Lakes with just Michigan and Ohio. So during the start of COVID, when all that MISC was starting to come out, we didn't really know of a definition of MISC. So our weekly calls were actually really helpful for us to understand how, you look at MISC, what were you doing for testing, you know, how many cases were you having? And just that situational awareness sort of across state lines really was very helpful to sort of understand what the region was doing. And then the one other thing that, and then obviously that got more formalized as Children's Hospital of Michigan actually went ahead and ended up doing a big study on it and sort of a case review because they seemed to be a hotbed for it. But the other thing that was actually really interesting was when we actually had testing available for COVID and the number of our ERs were overwhelmed in our region. And it was just, everybody was coming in. We were seeing three times as many patients as we could because families just wanted to be tested. They wanted their kids tested. They were worried, et cetera, et cetera. And really creating a strategy to get outpatient testing going in a very quick and rapid manner was really important. So, you know, we had the NDMS come in and help us set up some, remote testing sites and things like that. And I'm sure Jim can remember all that because that was happening across Ohio. But boy, in the children's hospitals, you know, the kids, and they didn't want to test kids at some of these walk-in sites. So the peds, EDs were overwhelmed until we were able to get the age lowered so that we could get kids tested. And so really working with community partners and figuring out how to do that with public health was super important for us to reduce our volumes.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Okay, thanks, Roxana. It's funny, Deanna, you bring up with MISC. I remember this was before Wisconsin was part of Region 5, and we heard, everyone knew that Children's Hospital of Michigan was getting hit really hard with this. And then we also heard that someone, Usha, gave a presentation to your group. We reached out to her. So we ended up internally throughout the region getting all that information to us, which was extremely helpful because that was just, it was scary. We weren't sure what we were looking for. We weren't sure how to do the treatment. So that was really helpful within the region that we had people that we could look to for that. Some of the things I found difficult is, and this is very basic now, PPE. We just did not use PPE on a regular basis. And when you did, it was always like, let's look in that manual to see which, you know, contact versus isolation. And I think just getting over that hump of PPE was such a big thing in the beginning of this. You'd have a patient decompensating and you're trying to figure out, am I putting my N95 on? Am I in a capper right now? There's just like, it was a lot of new equipment information that not many of us had trained on a regular basis. And I think that's a huge thing we've gained from COVID is that this is all pretty daily now with PPE, but also we couldn't get some of this. I think the supply issue very early on that we were unable to get a lot of just things where we were making our own masks and what did we have, what did we need and what were we going to use to protect ourselves, and disseminating that to the community in the beginning was very difficult because we didn't feel like we knew the information to confidently tell community members.
Yeah, I kind of going along with what Deanna had mentioned. One of the, I think, most difficult things is that we were so overwhelmed with the number of patients, both high acuity and low acuity, and kind of at the same time. A lot of our primary care offices weren't seeing sick patients. And so a lot of the patients that parents would, you know, take in typically to see their pediatrician, they were coming to us. We were being seen for tests, for school notes. And then we were also getting those really sick kids. They were starting to come in too. And so the overwhelming numbers of patients and that, trying to handle the really sick ones. And then also the patient that waited 4 hours for a test and is really angry. I think that was one of the things that made that triage more difficult.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm seeing a lot of head nods. I think a lot of common elements here. Dr. Chapman, Dr. Brumbaugh, and Dr. Denenberg, curious about some of your challenges.
I think one of the more significant challenges for us, we're a freestanding children's hospital, and was trying to decide our comfort level with taking care of adults, because really, you know, in pediatrics, until we got into that summer RSV season where we really got hit, we had very low volumes throughout this time. And so the question was always, what can we do to assist other hospital systems? And preparing your hospital system to, you know, to be on the same page about that was a heavy lift. In fact, I'm quite certain we weren't on the same page, you know. But we do take care of older patients largely in, you know, pockets of adult congenital heart disease or young adult cancers and so forth. But generally in our med-surg and in our typical ICU, you know, there's not a lot of that. And so making sure that what we were committing to the community, who desperately needed us to be flexible in who we saw, was internally accepted, known, and prepared for, became one of my challenges that we haven't mentioned yet.
Yeah, I would say similarly, we took a lot of adults into our children's hospital because we're free-leaning, right? So we're freestanding, but we're connected by a hallway to a 800-bed adult hospital. So we shared space, we shared staff, we shared physicians, we shared all kinds of things. But I think the biggest challenge that we faced was messaging and communication with community, because we were seeing all of these adult patients. We were having patients in the hallway. We were, you know, especially during our second surge, we were hearing stories about our friends at Children's Hospital of Michigan. And in the meantime, we were being told on the news, kids don't get sick. Yet at the same time on our Monday calls, we were talking about who's going to take which kid for ECMO and where are we going to, because only a few places do ECMO in our state. So I think that the working with the state and working with the community was the toughest part, was really getting that message out that kids can get really sick from this. This isn't an adult only disease. And I think we struggled with that a little bit, especially in the beginning.
Yeah. I agree with what Emily and Matt have already brought up. I think other challenges, so I'm PEDS ID background. And so one of the things I did especially was helping to develop our treatment algorithms, both for MISC and COVID. And what was interesting was, of course, like we've already mentioned, a lot of emphasis was on adult care, not so much pediatric care. And so for better or worse. And so it was really good that we would meet with our adult counterparts with developing treatment algorithms that could translate over to the PEDS side or be adapted to the PEDS side. I think other challenges that we started to encounter actually was towards, as we got deeper into the pandemic and reopened our surgeries, our elective surgeries, trying to cope with how do you handle a positive test? What does a positive test mean? So actually we promoted a non-test approach at our facility where you assume everyone was positive and just donned the appropriate PPE, given that we had supplies for PPE available at that point and the turnaround time of testing wasn't as great relative to when an OR time was.
Yeah, very good. Jim and Kathleen, anything to add here in addition to what's been said?
Yeah, this is Kathleen. One of the things I was going to share with you guys is that in Chicago, we are not only, we're a pediatric freestanding hospital, but we're also an Ebola center. We're one of three in the city of Chicago, and we take all the peds. So one of the things that we did or learned from H1N1, as was mentioned earlier, was when we did a hot wash after that, we realized we were seeing 400 kids a day for weeks on end, and none of them, to be honest with you, well, some were, were not quite sick. So they were really worried well. And so we established after that, even though we never used it, a plan to use one of our offsites so that and we did this with COVID. So early on, we took an offsite that actually wasn't going to see patients because they all got canceled. Families were afraid to come in, and use that as a testing center for anybody that was referred. So initially that didn't start right away because the city of Chicago Public Health would call us and call the emergency room and say, we're sending you over a patient. And that was just got to be, and then it was like, we're getting six a day, but it got a little crazy because you had to prepare like you would for an Ebola patient for them. So I think once we established, which was shortly after that, the, when we talk about, you know, how do we overcome some of this, just offloading the testing to an off a site, not the emergency room, really, really helped us. But I have to agree, everything you guys are saying, we've had very similar experiences with. So thanks for sharing them.
And I'll add in that I think the awareness of multi-system involvement in pediatric patients, I cannot overemphasize how that was so necessary for all healthcare providers to kind of indoctrinate into their practice. And then I go back to the fact that this was an evolving body of knowledge about the pandemic. I mean, we were learning things by the hour in some situations. We were dealing with supply chain issues. And those issues changed. I mean, I heard someone mention ECMO earlier. I remember at one point, you know, through state coordination, I think it was New Year's Eve, actually, there was literally no ECMO. There were no circuits available in the state, but for the fact that we did have one person, you know, who then came off of ECMO. But, you know, unprecedented lengths of time on ECMO. So we were working with adult and pediatric hospitals for all available circuits, units, providers. And it was something as simple as saying, where are the units in our state? Like, what's the inventory? And if I need to call someone, how do I do that in a very, very fast manner? So I don't need to jump through hoops. I mean, it's not just calling a transfer center, but how does this work? And so the value of the state hospital associations trying to coordinate those forums and getting people together. I will also say that Dr. Del Grove and I communicate frequently. When she sends something to me to be distributed outward, I take it very seriously because it's just in time type information, but I think the value is getting the message to the right people. It's not just establishing the need to know, but the value of knowing. Because many times people will say, well, that doesn't pertain to me. I'm not a pediatric provider. Well, do you have an emergency department? Do you have a community? And if you do, this is something that you need to consider. And we're all part of communities, right? So we all serve communities. And I think that those were lessons learned that we had. And I think, Deanna, you might agree that we do have that really good communication between the coalitions and then getting that information outward.
James, this regional work is so important because of what you just said. I will just say one thing. I was the triage officer during the height of the adult pandemic, the adult surge here at Spectrum. And I was getting calls from Jacksonville, Florida for ECMO patients to come to Michigan because there was no circuits in the southern state. So these coalitions are so critical.
Yeah, and I would say, Matt, also just to add to that, that when we look at something as simple as ECMO, the first round of surge with ECMO was that we had patients who were on for so long, their stay was so long on circuit. But then within months, that shifted to we had plenty of circuits, we just didn't have the staff. And so we had, you know, hospitals that had to close down circuits because they couldn't staff them appropriately. And so it was a different twist on the same problem. And how you handle that, of course, is a little different. So convening people to talk this out and come up with strategies was so very important. I know many of my colleagues from the state hospital associations are on this call. I'm sure you've done similar work as well. And if you did, thank you very much.
Yeah. So this is where I would make a really good plug for the concept that I think Michigan is really sort of working on, which is the pediatric medical operations cell. To be embedded in a medical operations cell at the state level, which really is a great concept that I think Ron Ruffing has been working on out of Children's Hospital of Michigan, that really sort of sets the stage for how do you create the scaffolding to support staff, to meet the communication structures and things like that, so that when you need these kinds of things, they go into place. So it's a really great thing for a pediatric, you know, kind of element, I think it only works if you have it for sort of all medical elements, because we all know that things that you do regularly and you use every day will actually be much more available to you in a disaster or some kind of big situation. So, you know, somehow embedding these kinds of concepts, and we've done a nice exercise on that through Region 5, and actually have a pediatric surge workshop coming up in August that's going to take a closer look at some of this stuff, which I think all of you have probably been invited to because you're from Region 5. So
one of the interesting learnings that we had about that was, you know, we had previously been a part of, you know, listening in on a regular basis, of course, to our adult, quote unquote, coalition and, you know, daily calls and sorting out, you know, where the most critical patients were and so forth. And then the emerging need to have a pediatric focused call that really could just look at pediatric patients. But very quickly, we learned you really need both, because there was a need to flex our health systems and, you know, and think about if you've got a 24-year-old patient in an adult system, you really have to understand what's sitting there in the adult system as you're thinking about what's in the, you know, what the pediatric providers are identifying. And of course, the calls that would come from out of state and need a centralized hub to consider those patients. So we bounced back and forth a little bit with that concept of do we do a pediatric portion of the full of the adult call? Do we do a separate huddle? Do people have to attend both huddles? Ultimately, we felt like one foot in each canoe was important for us to be able to effectively help triage those calls that came for pediatric critical care, that you had to have that picture of the adult systems. Once again, that was less the height of COVID than it was the surge of illness as community restrictions lifted. And we had the surge of illness in addition to, you know, some the oncoming Delta and so forth. So it became a perfect storm, created by our own social movements.
Yeah, thank you. Appreciate the discussion. That was some great points. If I could just ask to the group briefly, we only have a couple minutes remaining, so I wanted to ask just one final question. So because of COVID-19, all the preparations, everything that transpired, how would this cause you to respond differently to a pediatric pandemic in the future? For the group, if anyone wants to answer that.
I would just start off by saying, Duane, that load balancing took on a completely different definition for me. It wasn't just about beds, it was about staffed beds. It wasn't about ECMO units, it's about staffed ECMO units, or, you know, IV fluids that weren't available, or oxygen that was not, you know, high flow oxygen that wasn't available. How do you do this?
I would intentionally, and now before we have a surge, tackle the ethics of scarce resources in pediatrics. It was kind of glossed over. You know, we did a lot of that work in the adults in a hurry, and it was great work. And we did it in Michigan, they did it in Ohio, they did it across the country. Peds was like an appendix to the work because kids weren't getting sick enough, and we knew we could handle the volume as it was happening. But I think we have to make sure we're ready, because I don't think we could make the same scarce decisions for peds that we made in the adult world, but we're going to have to.
Yeah, and this is where I think this is, the tool that Matt has been working on with Javari that helps us see beds and, you know, staff beds, unstaffed beds, what type of beds, things like that, is actually a very robust tool. And I think they've worked on the pediatric dashboard really well. And having something like that for children's hospitals is really going to help to load balance. But, you know, we don't load balance, as Roxana even pointed out, you know, having hospitals ready to take care of kids in your critical access hospitals, your rural hospitals, because that's just as important as having the children's hospitals know about stuff. So we are part of a whole big system, and we're only one component. And I think it's really important that we understand our role in that. And, you know, we are definitely working on strengthening our children's hospitals in Region 5, as well as incorporating a lot of the stuff that we're doing with the Pediatric Pandemic Network now across the nation. So I think it's we've definitely built a lot of great collaboration, great tools, and I think more ideas are coming, and understanding how we integrate into the whole system so that we can create awareness for pediatric issues for everyone.
Yeah, thank you. I wish we could go on. As obvious, it's, you know, there's a lot of great discussion points here. And I just really want to thank this group, not only for the discussions, but for what you do every day. day to day in your communities. You're all experts, and you all do a tremendous amount of work. So that's very evident, and we appreciate what you do. I just wanted to also mention to the listeners that if you want to submit a question, I see a couple did come in, I believe, in chat. You could raise your hand if you prefer to speak live. That's fine as well. And again, thank you. And Megan, I'll turn it back to you.
Great. Thank you all so much. Thank you to all the panelists for, again, for such wonderful conversation. And of course, thank you to Captain Wagner for moderating today's discussion. We wish we had more time because I think we all really, really benefited from hearing from all of you. So very much appreciate it. Due to time, I'm going to go ahead and transition us into the general Q&A. So Jennifer, I'll go ahead and turn it over to you. And then if no questions come in, we can go ahead and answer some of those questions that came in the chat for the panel.
Great. Thanks, Megan. And as Megan stated, we have a few minutes before the top of the hour. So we would like to open a line for any other questions, either to our presenters or for ASPR in general. I did see a question that just came in. It says, were there any updates on if an annual tangible property report is required to be submitted under the ASPR grant? It was going to be looked into at the last meeting. That tangible property report is only required for the end of the project period. You do not have to submit it annually.
I think there's one point made in the chat about pediatric clinicians caring for adults and adult clinicians caring for children as a key asset, a force multiplier, and a disaster response. And I completely agree with that. I will say I struggled more with whether we had the flexibility in our nursing staff. I found that my clinicians felt more comfortable, you know, flexing one way or another, and had a good solid phone a friend and felt like they could support each other, but our nursing teams felt particularly uncomfortable. So it's a consideration when we think about disaster planning for us to make sure that we think beyond just the clinician.
Yeah, thank you for covering that, and thank you for that comment. I believe we also got a comment in from John Wilgus from the Florida Hospital Association, said that they worked with their hospitals and healthcare coalitions to help with COVID response issues like identifying ECMO beds. The HCCs were a tremendous help as our state public health emergency was allowed to expire in June 2021, and our usual state partners were not as engaged. So that's a really great point about being able to leverage those healthcare coalitions within the jurisdiction. So thank you for that comment as well. I see that we are 1 minute from the top of the hour, so I'm going to go ahead and move to closing today's, give the closing remarks for today's meeting. But I want to, of course, thank all of our presenters and our panelists for their time today, and to all of you for your active participation in today's meeting. I mean, as you saw that the agenda was jam-packed with a lot of great information and a lot of great, phenomenal information. And as Duane stated, you know, of course, we want to thank our panelists for being on today's call, but also want to thank them for what they do. And want to thank all of you that are participating on today's call for all that you do. I know that sometimes you probably don't get thanked enough, but you're certainly appreciated by ASPR and all of us here within the National Healthcare Preparedness Program. As a reminder, we invite you to share any stories regarding how you or your member hospitals are using ASPR funding to make a positive impact on your community. And if you have a story to share, please fill out our Stories from the Field submission form or reach out to your field project officer for more information. And a member of our team will drop the Story from the Field submission form link in the chat for easy reference. And we look forward to hearing about the great work that you are doing. And I would be remiss before I end the call. of also thanking Shane Brandman and Dr. John Hicks for the great presentation and demonstration on the DASH tool. And I think all of us are looking forward to that rolling out on Monday. And just a reminder about that that upcoming webinar on August 15th at 11:30 a.m. Eastern Time, and more information will be forthcoming regarding that. But again, thank you everyone for joining today's call, and we want to wish you and hope that you have a great day and a great week. So thank you, everyone.